This is an interview with Governor Victor Atiyah at Atiyah International in downtown Portland, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is July 9th, 1993. And this is tape 45, side one. You wanted to begin with a discussion about the economic base?
Yeah. When I should start another way. Having been in the retail business, for all my life until I was elected governor, you get a kind of really feel of the economy of Oregon, because obviously that relates to how our business is going to be. And I became really painfully aware how narrow our economic base was. It included the timber, agriculture, and to some degree, although struggling, was tourism. So as we talked earlier, and I'd said many times before, I persisted in terms of economic development. And we talked about going to Japan. I spoke about the high-tech companies that we had here. But we worked very hard on it. One of the real successes, genuine and permanent, is the fact that we expanded that economic base. Timber, agriculture, full-blown tourism. And we spoke earlier about the Tourism Advisory Council and how we pulled them all together. Mm-hmm. And then it really began to click and click very well. We added to Tektronix, which was our really the East, as I call it, in terms of high technology. Intel had come in before I was governor, but then we had Hewlett Packard. Intel, before I left, said they were going to do all their expansion in Oregon. But we then added, of course, NEC. We talked about Fujitsu's both America and Microelectronic, Seiko Epson. And since then, others have come. And we talked about my travels. You asked about what's the value of the Middle East, for example, or you didn't, but speculated in the media, and to the Middle East and then the Far East. But we added international trade. The measuring stick was when I became governor, 1 in 9 jobs related to international trade. When I left office, 1 in 6. So we now have 5 pillars, or foundation stones, I should say, to the economic base that we didn't have when I went in. Mm-hmm. But it was one of those things that I persisted for 8 years. I knew what I wanted to do, how I wanted to get it done, how I wanted to kind of clear the decks to make it happen. And the real signal was that during the recession that we had, and the country was in recession, where typically Oregon would have taken a nosedive, because I'd seen it happen, Oregon remained under the national average for unemployment all during that period of time. Mm. And I was reading the newspapers, and the economists would say we're doing well because the diversity of our economy. And I'd kind of smile to myself. Well, that's what we were trying to do. I would say that if the timber industry weren't so beleaguered right now with spotted owl and old growth and all kinds of things, that the economy of Oregon would be absolutely booming. As it is, it's doing okay. We're about, or maybe slightly over, the national average. We're certainly not in any kind of recession. But we've been really battered in the timber industry side of it. Had we not, however, expanded that base, we would be in deep, deep trouble.
Do you feel that you've gotten the credit due for having expanded the base the way you have?
No. It's, you know, there's a lot of things that I think we'll find a recap that I want to talk about. But, you know, we didn't put all the fanfare and bedeck flags and loudspeakers and all the rest of that. We just knew what had to be done. We went ahead and did it. And so there's a lot of people, you know, really don't recognize that they know it's here and they know it happened, but they're not quite sure how it happened. It's just sort of osmosis. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, I really believe, truly believe, that the theory that I expounded, you just can't believe how much you can do if you don't care who gets the credit. I believe that, which is kind of hard for politicians to do. They want to get credit for what somebody else did. But, I just believe that's, you know, as I say, this is good for Oregon. Let's go do it. And that's my satisfaction. That's my personal satisfaction. Anyway, I think I need to clearly define that, because I count it as a major success of my years as governor. A lot of people talk about that Governor Attia did well because he managed the state in tough times. I'm proud of that, but that's all I mentioned. There's a lot of other things, which I'm proud of and that are notable.
Maybe in the same way that you talk about the economy of Oregon would be just extremely robust if it weren't for the timber industry, perhaps the obvious effects of your administration would have been much more apparent had it not been for the recession and you're having to deal with all the restraints from that.
Yeah, we probably would have moved faster. We would have gotten into this prevention thing we did talk about. Probably moved into higher education earlier, those kinds of things. But, you know, you take the times as they come and do the best with them as you can. You know, when you're working on economic development during the time of a recession, it's a little difficult. I said many times, you know, it's very hard to have a fire prevention program when you're fighting a forest fire, which is what the recession was all about.
But you were putting a lot of emphasis on electronics at the time, and during the same period, wasn't Silicon Valley and some of these other areas finding a change in their growth patterns and actually withdrawal?
Yes, actually early on we went to Silicon Valley, San Jose, and they were having some real problems. They were having problems of because they were growing as rapidly as they were, you know, holding employees. They were just moving back and forth. They had to retrain people, and everybody was robbing everybody else. And in addition to that, they could see how it was getting congested. The cost of living was terribly high, and they were looking to expand, but outside of the San Jose. With our proximity and direct flights to San Jose, and you know all of these things, that really were quite close in a relative sense. Oregon was, I thought, a very good target for that. And they looked seriously, many of them, seriously coming to Oregon. But they went into this recession.
Right.
And so then they had to start letting people go. And what turned out is that all of a sudden they found themselves with unused capacity in California. So they talk of expansion, they were in retrenchment and had unused capacity. And so they became less, although, as I told you, Intel moved up. And they saw what was going on, and they said their expansion will take place in Oregon. It has. For a long time, they were stagnant. They built a building which they didn't occupy for, I think, 2-3 years. But now that they're back, and they're growing, in Oregon. So, you know, I feel good about what's happened now. I said, and no one really understood, no one understood nearly as well as I did. When I left office, Oregon was better positioned than any other state that I knew of, and certainly better than California and the state of Washington for our economic future, because we had established a good base. It was a diversified base. We had cleared the decks.
How was it better than Washington and California? They seem to be even more diversified in some ways.
Well, California's got some horrendous problems. They actually are in recession, and particularly the further south you go, the worse it gets. That's lingered. Washington, I've said many times, and they've said the same, the good news is they have Boeing. The bad news is they have Boeing. And now they're in retrenchment. Boeing is such a huge employer that their effect is just immediate. We have a huge employer, which is our timber industry, but it's not one company.
Right.
It's a lot of companies, and some do better than others. So, and besides that, the cost of living was good here. Our taxation method was good here. Our land use planning was good. That was in place. Our environmental laws were well known and well done. It's a good place to live. Transportation improved immensely. We had United Airlines with one trip to the Middle East on Tuesday to Japan. Lousy day they gave us. But then I went back to Washington and spoke on behalf of Delta, and Delta used us as their hub. And now they're really doing extremely well into the Far East. So we have an international branch and good transportation. We have a good highway system, a good rail system. Not that California and Washington don't, but and a good port. So we've got a lot of structural things that are good, plus it's a very livable place, and the cost of living is good.
Previous Oregon governors and the federal delegation have been very leery about federal installations in terms of military and things like that in Oregon, and yet some states have found that's been a good way to diversify, and that they have sort of a balance to their other economies. How have you felt about Oregon's aspect in terms of federal input?
I never really sought that kind of thing. You know, if it had come, that would have been fine, but it wasn't anything that I worked for or tried to get. Because I realize that tide comes and goes. And if you're so heavily dependent, certainly on military, who knows? The military budget's constant and being attacked by a lot of people. So, you know, to me it was kind of transitory, really too thin a reed for us to hang our hat on, and so it wasn't anything I even tried to get. We notice now, actually part of California's problem, particularly Southern California, is that they were so heavily dependent upon the military, and it's a severe cutback. And all these huge, huge companies, now are quite small if they exist at all. And that's thousands of employees. So they get hit pretty hard. So we have the advantage, I guess, in this case, of not having it. And I think that's okay, because I have no problem with that.
What other areas, aside from the expansion of tourism and electronics and maintaining our agricultural base, were you looking at in terms of expanding our economic base?
Nothing really. I do believe that Oregon is a good place for headquarters for companies, particularly as the communications improve so vastly. Mm-hmm. Where one is located really isn't important anymore.
But we have an income tax, and Washington doesn't.
But they have a business and occupation tax. For businesses there, whether they make money or not, they pay a tax.
But corporate executives would probably prefer, with their high salaries, not to live in a place that had income taxes or high income taxes.
That's true. And yet, on the other hand, we can go back and forth, because I've done this comparison, particularly of recent years. The executive can deduct their state tax from their federal tax.
Still?
In Oregon. But you cannot deduct a sales tax. So they'd be, buying and spending over there and paying taxes, none of which they can deduct. So it's a gross payout. These top executives with large salaries are probably taxed at the rate of about 40%. So effectively, the federal government's paying 40% of their state income tax. It's not a bad deal. But there are comparisons back and forth. I had said earlier that Oregon, maybe I didn't. I was telling somebody else's story, but Oregon, I watched in Commerce Clearinghouse. In other words, this is not my figure. It's Clearinghouse, and they would measure total taxes, not one tax, but total taxes. And Oregon always rated much lower than most of the western states. Maybe Idaho would be lower than we would at times. But of the 11 western states, including Nevada and Utah and New Mexico and Arizona, it was their figures, Commerce Clearinghouse. I've seen repeatedly whatever they call it, the Washington Association of Business, whatever that's called, and they're complaining about their tax and tax system. And you know, if they're going to come here and build something, well, if they go to Washington and build something, everything that they buy to build that building, lumber, windows, cement, electric, whatever it is, they pay a sales tax for it. Mm-hmm. In Oregon, they don't do that. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, in Oregon, we've got a statute that would indicate that until you're up and actually running, you don't pay property taxes on that would be the building. You'd pay on the property. Mm-hmm. We passed that a number of years ago. So you don't pay any property taxes till it's up and going.
Of course, part of the growth of Vancouver has been in the fact that they've been able to, you know, encourage people to settle there so that they wouldn't be paying high property taxes or income taxes, and yet could buy in Oregon and not pay the sales tax.
Well, I would say to you that there really isn't any green pasture. I'm not saying Oregon's a green pasture, but I'm surely saying to you at Washington is not a green pasture. There is no such a thing. But if you sit down with a pen and pencil, mm-hmm. you'll figure out that it's better to be in Oregon than it is Washington. Now, you compare one thing or another thing, you know, one-on-one, but I'm saying total package. Right. Let's look at the whole package, not just a piece of the package. Right. But yeah, Vancouver's done very well, and what we've done in Oregon has been one of their selling tools. They're right next to the Portland International Airport, mm-hmm. and that's a good deal. They have all of the cultural attractions, bike crossing the river, the Performing Arts Center, our Historical Society, our museum, you know, all the mm-hmm. you count it, Japanese gardens and all. That's right here. So, and it didn't cost them a nickel, but it's part of, certainly part of their package. I would hope it would be. And so what we have has been of some asset to Vancouver. And that's okay. I don't mind competing. I think we can with someone that sits down. You know, you figure out why did, Fujitsu Microelectronic, and I picked them because they have a very, very expensive installation. Not just the building, but all of the equipment inside to produce the silicon chips. That it's very expensive. I've forgotten how much. It was $60, $70 million get this thing going. Why did they come to Oregon? Why did NEC come to Oregon? We're competing with Washington, you understand. Mm-hmm. I know why Kyocera went to Washington. I know because we had not yet repealed the unitary tax. Had we done that, they'd have been here. Mm-hmm. And I know that by personal conversation. So we can continue to make those kind of comparisons, but and we don't have really the time for the tape, but the point is that while we were working with these companies, we were in competition with other states, and we were successful. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because they like Vicatea. They're coming because they want to make money. We have a very good workforce available, very loyal, meaning low turnover, mm-hmm. very productive, and which means that if they're assembling products, when it comes in the line, they don't kick it out. Those kinds of things are all an advantage to a manufacturing company. Now, ask about other things, and I said no, except that didn't happen. But I said to myself, well, there's no reason why we couldn't be corporate headquarters for a lot of companies. I did try, although. Now we're getting near the end of my term. I'm thinking to myself, pharmaceuticals would be good for Oregon. Certainly with our Health Science Center and all the things that have happened since then, mm-hmm. with Mark Hatfield and the scientific research that's going on, which is really world-class stuff. And I, well, pharmaceuticals would be good, but we never really pursued it. But I do want to say one thing. I know enough about business to know that although we talk about small business, and of course I'm a small businessman, and I would tell you also that small business employs more people than any of the large companies. Mm-hmm. The thing is that you do need the original wealth is a large manufacturing plant. That's the original. Mm-hmm. And I sort of call myself a camp follower. I'm going to be there in the sense that if I've got a market, for example, in my case, rugs and carpets, I'm there. The drugstore is there. The grocery store is there. The shoe store is there. You see, but you have to begin with. You can't have small business people doing business with small business people. This is not going to get you anywhere. You have to have this manufacturing thing to generate something. Mm-hmm. And then we, small business people, were sort of camp followers. Mm-hmm. And all the rest follows. So I knew that you didn't really have to work on that end of it. It was going to come. Stationery stores, greeting card stores, hair salons, name it, keep on going. Mm-hmm. But you have to begin with this manufacturing base. And then the rest comes along with it.
Well, shall we go on to the last legislative session?
Yes.
The 1985 legislative session, the 63rd Assembly, which ran from January 14th to June 21st, 1985. Actually, now that I look at it, that's kind of a shorter legislative period when you mm-hmm. think of...
Well, you think of certainly this one, which is not over yet. We're July, July 9th. They're going to go near the end of July.
Gee. But they've had others that have gone just as long.
And yeah, but I think they're going to break the record that they had while I was there. They had the longest legislative session and the shortest special session while I was governor.
What do you attribute that to, this session? Why is it?
Well, they just don't know quite what to do. Mm-hmm. I was reading this morning's paper now. The Revenue Committee has kind of shifted gears. Well, this is about the third time they shifted gears. And that which also tells you, we're not sure what to do. We'll try this. Well, that isn't going to work. Well, let's try that. Well, this isn't going to work. And each time they spend time at it.
And what do you attribute that to? Is it the leadership?
Generally, lack of leadership. Generally, and I'm speaking now of the governor's office because legislature has to have some bone to chew on, mm-hmm. and there really isn't any bone out of the governor's office for them to chew on. I don't like this. What the governor's plan, so this is the plan we're going to deal with, but at least some bone to chew on.
But didn't she have a special legislative session just to give them a bone to chew on, and they rejected it?
Well,
we can talk about that later. But since we're on the topic,
that
it might
was
be
dumb. Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk about that one later. Also, this session did something that has never been done before, at least to my knowledge. But the House and Senate no longer are in joint ways and means. They used to be joint ways and means so that effectively the Senate and the House heard budget bills at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so that when they went through one body, the Senate already had heard the same thing. So it moved rather quickly. That's not the case now. The House is having their own hearings and the Senate's having their own hearings. And they're going to come to different conclusions, and they're going to have to go to conference committee. That delays the session. Plus the fact that continually deterioration, I would call it, of experienced people in the legislature. Unable to make decisions, not enough background to know how to make a decision, worried about their re-election so they don't know what decision to make. All of that contributes to a long session.
Well, in the 85 session, we had Vera Katz as Speaker again and Larry Campbell in the minority, as the Republican leader. And in the Senate, we had John Kitzhaber as President again. How did you look upon their leadership?
You mean Katz and Kitzhaber?
Kitz and Katz.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I thought they did a good job.
Mm-hmm. And you worked with them pretty well?
Oh, yeah. That obviously doesn't mean agreement. It was a lot better than Karens and Fadeley. Mm-hmm. A lot better.
Oh, that was that the last session, Karens and Fadeley?
I think it was.
Yeah, I think you're right. So maybe this was the first that they were both together then. But even though they were both Democrats, you worked with them pretty well.
It didn't really make any difference. Mm-hmm. My interest was what's good for Oregon. Mm-hmm. I say both privately and out loud, this is not a game, and so many of them treat it like a game. Whatever we do or don't do is going to affect Oregonians. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a game. It's not a game for me to play. I'll be a partisan when it comes election time, but when we start dealing with laws or laws not passing, that's entirely different. It's not a game. There are real human beings that are Oregonians out there, and what we do or don't do is going to affect them. And that's the way I always looked at it. So whether they were Democrats or not, it didn't make that much difference.
In your 1984 State of the State address, you brought up several things that you were trying to accomplish. One was a proposed reduction in the state's personal income tax.
Yes.
And then, of course, the unitary taxes, which yes. we've already talked about. And then also, you repeated your support for legislation now before Congress that would establish the Columbia River Gorge Commission.
Yes.
Where was that going at the time? That was before Congress, but how did it look?
I should look it up in terms of timing. You're talking about the gorge now?
That's right.
Okay. I'll tell you the full story of that one. That actually began way back at the very beginning in 1979. And I have a great deal of personal affection for the gorge. I think it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking about trying to get the right terms, preservation. I'm talking more about protection. Mm-hmm. And what the difference in my mind, so at least I'll explain it for the tape, is that there are businesses there and there are people living there. Mm-hmm. And it was not my intention to run them out of there, to allow them to continue to live, to make a living, and to grow. But it was a matter of protection, the gate, so there would be some orderliness to whatever occurred. Mm-hmm. Oregon had done, because we had our land use laws, had done a really good job. The real problem was getting the attention of the state of Washington. The state of Washington had one beautiful view as they drove up their gorge, but we're looking to Washington. They're looking to Oregon. We're looking on the Washington side. But they really didn't have that much interest. And certainly the real population center is Seattle, a long way from the Columbia River. Mm-hmm. A lot of them never have seen the gorge, and they could care less about the gorge. And you get to Olympia, and that's still quite a ways from the river. So to get Washington's attention, to make them think it's an important thing, was not an easy thing to do. I have to remember when, but I persisted because it was something I wanted to get done. And finally, I did get an agreement from Governor Spellman. So now we've done something that was important to do. Mm-hmm. And Governor Spellman and I signed an agreement as to the general framework for gorge protection. It wasn't a definitive bill, but this was a framework. That then got the attention, of course, the Washington delegation in Congress, and certainly helped the Oregon delegation in Congress. So now we have the two states that are involved, mm-hmm. Oregon and Washington, going down the same track. So that was the real kickoff for this thing. There were a lot of people that worked on the gorge bill. And some of the environmental folks, you know, were just wild. As a matter of fact, I had some arguments with them, and they really wanted to lock up the gorge. And I told them, I said, you persist this way, we're not going to get anything. Mm-hmm. And they got mad at me about that. But the fact is that it did finally move, and it moved through Congress. It got quite a bit of attention locally on both sides of the river. By those that didn't want anything to happen, mm-hmm. And those that wanted to lock it up, and we had to get somewhere in between those two. Mark Hatfield was the real prime mover that finally got it going, and it finally passed Congress. But I will tell you something, there's rarely